Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Filmcast, a podcast about movies. I'm David Chen, and I would never participate in an endurance match with two other friends where the goal is to see how long we can last until we slowly pass away one by one, unless it was called a podcast. Joining me today is Devendra Hardwar.
Finally, a sequel to Robert Zemeckis' The Walk.
And Jeff Cannata.
My favorite long walk is still the one I use to cook stir fry.
Wow. Where that joke you told last week?
Oh, yeah. I don't know. I don't know
about that
one. I think
that should be your favorite long walk.
Don't know about that one, Jeff. Don't know about that one. A little bit, racial. A little bit racial, Jeff.
Anyway.
Those are, of course, all vague and oblique references to the fact that today on the podcast, we're going to be reviewing Stephen King / Francis Lawrence's latest film, The Long Walk, which is out in theaters this weekend. You can find more episodes of the show at thefilmcast.com. Email us at /filmcast@gmail.com. Support the podcast at patreon.com/filmpodcast. We are going to discuss a little tiny bit of Hollywood news. The Emmys were last night. We are going to do a / film court where we adjudicate your movie-related dilemmas. We got some what we've been watching, some weekly plugs, and then we're going to get to our main review of The Long Walk. But first, FYI, this morning I was awoken by some of the loudest sounds I've ever heard outside of this house. I may have mentioned in a previous episode there's some construction going on near my house, and they have decided that today is the day that they are going to cut down every single tree on the property and feed it through a wood chipper. So it's just the scene from, you know, that scene from Fargo where that guy's getting fed through a wood chipper, except imagine it's 10 times louder because it's actual trees that have been in this earth for 100 years.
In fact, the wood chipper's job. Yeah, rather than a human body being
grounded. That's right. It is ungodly loud. And I have moved into a closet, which is still very loud in the background. I don't know if the audio is going to sound good in this one. I literally just moved into this closet, I'm going to say 15 minutes before the podcast began, because I was just like kind of scrambling to figure out a solution to this. So if my audio is a little weird, sorry about that, but I'll try to mute when I'm not talking, and hopefully it'll sound okay. Anyway, the joys of producing audio-based content, guys. Let's talk about the Emmys. The Emmys were last night. Should point out that all of us are familiar with the winners, but I am the only one that watched the telecast. I took this bullet for you guys.
Don't value your time.
I went on my own long walk, as it were, watching this telecast. But, you know, let's talk just a little bit about the awards first, right? And then we can get into the telecast itself. But I would say this is a very solid set of winners. Some really, how I describe it is a little bit of something for most people. A little bit of something for they spread the love around a little bit. It wasn't like one show completely swept everything. The studio did a little bit of that, but I'll just list some of the big winners. Best drama series was The Pit. Very good show.
Hell yeah.
And best comedy series was The Studio. And The Studio did get a lot of love last night. All that said, curious, gents, you are familiar with the awards. Anything that stuck out to you? Jeff Cannata, what do you think?
I was pleased that almost everything that was awarded something was a show that I either very much like or very much admire. Adolescence, of course, we know I'm on record as not being able to really watch, but I certainly admire that show. There's, you know, lots. I love the fact that Andor got an Emmy. I love the fact that I'm a huge fan of Hacks, Severance getting Emmys, even Kristen Milioti from The Penguin. I think I'm the only one on this show that really dug that show.
That's not true. I liked it as well, and I thought she was magnificent in the
She's
show.
Great.
She was the best part of the show. So it was wonderful to see her get awarded for that, especially because I don't know that the Emmys usually reward comic book / superhero films in this way. Maybe they do, but I can't recall it happening that often.
That is a surprising win, just because that show, like, I like that show. There are a couple of things that keep that show from being like top tier for me, but they chose the best thing of that show, I guess. So makes sense.
Yeah, she was awesome in the show.
Nobody saw Disclaimer. I think that's it. Cate Blanchett was nominated for Disclaimer. Nobody saw that show. Yeah. They saw what episode they tapped
out. They saw that Cate Blanchett was in it, so she needs to be nominated.
Well, first, yeah. I mean, I, for just as FYI, I saw the show. Have you, Devendra? I think yes, we talked about
we
it.
Talked we talked about it.
I watched the first episode.
Yeah, it's an inscrutable show, basically. So yeah,
it's a ridiculous show, in my opinion.
Yeah,
the way the plot unfolds is very, very silly. After you get to the end, in retrospect, in my opinion, what a weird thing though. It's I think it's Alfonso Cuarón did that show.
Yeah,
right?
And so the Cuarón coming back after a long time,
super talented director, and yet
that show looks incredible.
It's a beautiful show. Yeah. Beautiful show. Yeah. But yeah, anyway. Yeah, we got to see Severance awarded with a couple of acting awards. Mm-hmm. Tremel Tillman and Britt Lower won.
I loved seeing him win. I thought his speech was fantastic. Clearly, mm-hmm. he wrote it and took time to make it right and do it right. I thought lovely sentiment with his mom. Beautiful. You know, I really like the studio, but it's no surprise to me that the studio won so many awards. I mean, it's literally all the people that vote. It's all of you.
Amazing world we live in.
It's a show about you. Don't you love you?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Devendra Hardwar, anything from the Emmys stick out to you this year?
What's his face? The kid from Adolescence getting the award is that's kind of
youngest,
incredible.
The youngest so Emmy young. Award winner ever, which is astonishing. And he was excellent.
Incredible
in the show. So
yeah,
I mean, Jeff, you didn't even see his.
I know
his
but
best work.
What I saw was amazing, and right. you know, just having to go through that kind of trauma as a kid for art deserves some kind of recognition.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, Devendra,
Colbert winning is great too. Given the cancellation, given everything, that's like the final fuck you to CBS and Paramount, right? Yeah,
absolutely.
Good stuff.
So I would say the big winners were, like, coming away from the evening, the big winners were The Studio, Adolescence, and The Pit, right? Like, those were the shows that I felt like were really kind of dominating the evening. Of course, Hacks got some love as well, and Severance got a little bit of love as well. What is interesting to me is, despite dominating multiple categories in nominees, The White Lotus got completely shut out last night, and
I'm so shocked.
You guys have to understand the categories were out of control this year. I mean, you had some categories where I think it's Best Supporting Actress, right? That The White Lotus had four nominees in that category, and none of them won. So, well, guys, the strategy
happens,
right? That's not a good strategy. Like, it's not benefiting anyone. I mean, it's benefiting them because they're getting more attention on the show. But it's like they're taking the votes away from each other. Maybe don't try to get, you know, all six slots of the nominees filled with one show next time. Seems rather short-sighted to me.
Totally.
So of the three of us, I'm the only one that watched the telecast. And I have to say, guys, I found it to be pretty bad. It's one of the worst telecasts I have seen in recent memory. And a lot of it stems from the fact that Nate Bargatze, I've seen some of his work. It seems like a very talented individual. Yeah,
yeah, yeah. One of my favorite working comics right now.
He was I would describe phenomenal. It as a disaster in terms of his performance as host.
He was just on Conan's podcast talking about how excited he was to do the Emmys. Like, doing Conan's legacy proud. Oh, man.
His stage presence does not feel consistent with what you want from a award show host. Mm-hmm. He's very self-deprecating, very low, sort of contained, very understated, very, that's not what you're looking for with an MC of anything, really. You know, but he works great on stage on his stand-up. I love his stand-up. It's clean, it's hilarious, it's witty. I really, really think he's brilliant.
Absolutely. Well, they did a little SNL style sketch at the beginning that was not bad, and then the monologue was really lackluster, and then it concluded with a bit where there is a partnership with the Boys and Girls Club. And the idea was that if you went over your allotted 45 seconds of your speech, he was saying, I'm going to give $100,000 to charity, right? To the Boys and Girls Club. And, but if you go over, we'll take like $1,000 off for every second that you go over. And that way people are motivated to not go over for their speech, their thank you speeches. And I just have to say, it was a very, like, and look, I know it's just a bit. I know that at the end, they're going to give money to the Boys and Girls Club anyway. Like, they're not actually going to take money away from them. I understand that. It's still a very sad spectacle where, like, they would literally, and Jeff, I think you'd appreciate this as somebody who's hosted things. That was the whole bit for the rest of the show. Like, every time Nate came on stage, he would bring the tote board onto the, he'd be like, hey, what are we at on the big board? We're at like 85,000. Oh, it's gone down to 63,000. You know, that's the whole thing, was talking about how much money the Boys and Girls Club lost.
This was losing.
And it's a sad spectacle because you're positioning the thing that you want people to do at these award ceremonies, presumably, which is get on stage, show emotion, say something meaningful. And if they do that, you're punishing. And they would literally put on the screen the clock, the money counter, and like it going down as people are giving the speeches, and be like, you better get off the stage, you know, or else more money taken, you know?
Yeah.
And it was a really sad spectacle. It was really, and it wouldn't have necessarily been the worst if there's a couple ways they could have done it, right? They could have only come back to it at the end, right? Like, hey, we mentioned at the beginning and then like only come back to it at the end, or done other bits. And then in conjunction with this tote board thing, but literally that's all he did the whole show was talk about the board. It was like, hey, wow, the, you know, it's getting low now. You better hurry up next per, you know, like, that's the whole thing. It was excruciating. The whole thing was excruciating. So really painful.
Seems like a funny idea on paper, but in execution, not so much.
It's just, you have literally some of the richest people in the country and then serving up for our entertainment. Hey, we're taking money away from the Boys and Girls. I know it didn't actually happen. It didn't actually, at the end, he's like, we're actually giving away more than we committed to, you know, like, I understand they're not actually going to do that. But the idea that that is like the way we get our entertainment is, hey, we're making it so if you go over your speech, we're taking money away from these people. It's like, this sucks.
Yeah. Good thing nobody watches the Emmys, right? Nobody will see this fiasco.
Well, I think you say that sarcastically, but I haven't seen the ratings yet. As we're recording this, I haven't seen the ratings, but who knows? Maybe they were disastrous.
The Emmys is one of those things where you get there the morning it's happening. It's like, oh yeah, that tonight. Tonight I should watch the Emmys or do anything else with my life.
Indeed. Well, anyway, so all that said, the awards were good. Some of the speeches were good. And so it, you know, people got to get awarded for great work, and it highlighted some things that people might not have sought out yet. I do think people should check out Severance. I do think people should check out Adolescence. Like, those are things that are, and specifically Andor got a win, right?
So great.
Andor got points on the board. And at the end of the day, that's the most important thing. So
kind of vindication for the stuff we've spent the last year talking about too. So it's like, yes, we have highlighted some of the best shows. Jeff, have you watched The Pit yet?
You know, I watched
the
first.
You love The Pit.
I watched the first episode of The Pit, and I do think if I stuck with it, I would enjoy it. Yeah. But I know
new season in January. Weird. You've got a couple months.
Yeah. I don't like looking at body parts mutilated. I know it's not real. I'm not into the medic. Like, the show really leans into showing you the gruesome medical stuff.
It does.
And I was just, when I watched the first episode, I was like, I don't think I want to watch any more of this. You know, it's a very tense show. The whole vibe of it, I was just like, I don't want this right now. I'm not feeling this. I could possibly return to it and have a different feeling, but whatever it was, that moment that I watched it the first time, I was just, it kind of turned me off.
Let me make the case for it, Jeff. I think it's a brilliant show, and I actually think it's more important now than ever because, in my opinion, we are witnessing an assault on the concept of medical expertise in this country right now. And that is a show.
And science and everything.
And science and those things. And that show really values medical expertise. It valorizes the people that work in these hospitals, but it also values science. You know, it also values rigorous methodologies and things that I know, Jeff, you support. So anyway, I think
yeah, at its core, like, by the way, it's about giving a shit about each other,
right?
In the way that The Long Walk is, and I think you will appreciate that core, you know, philosophy, Jeff.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate that, it deserves to give it another chance. I just like, you know, describe the leg hanging off. Let's not zoom in on the leg hanging off. You know what I mean?
This is premium TV, Jeff. Look at the budget.
This is the stuff they couldn't do in ER, Jeff. Come on, man.
My imagination can do all the job. It can do the job. Some reason, you know, I'm not a huge fan of super gory horror stuff, but even that to me is preferable over like medically accurate gore.
Right, because you can kind of mentally distance yourself from it, right?
Yeah. Yeah, Freddy Krueger and Jason and all that stuff. Whatever, we're in make believe town. When it's like some dude at the hospital had to deal with that. I don't know. People can watch. I really cannot watch real life surgery videos. I have a aversion to that. A violent aversion to that. Like it makes me squeamish to a point where I also can't watch my own blood being taken.
Yeah.
You know, I have to turn away when the needle goes in. So I have weird stuff.
It's weird. I will say what is fascinating watching the pit. It's sort of like, this is something people have to do every day. People choose to do this. And it's like, how do you
beyond
do this?
Me. Yeah.
You know, it is wild that this exists.
The other thing about the pit, like, I guess, totally understand if you don't want to watch the show, Jeff. Yeah. Like, I'm not trying to pressure you to watch the show unduly. I just think it's like, it in many ways, in my opinion, the pit is a force for good in the culture. Not only about all the stuff we just said, but in addition, they're trying to make 15 episodes per season and release them once per year, which
is
a rarity in this TV environment where they're making a show and then 4 years later you get to watch season two of the show, right?
They
and
make six episodes and then you wait years
years for the next, and like now
I don't necessarily think that's, you know,
more than 12 episodes these days.
You don't think that's bad? You're saying
I
you
think
need to wait.
That it takes time to make great art, and great art it, you don't have to make it in bulk like you're at Costco. I think what I prefer is let it bake, make it right, make exactly the amount that you think you can make. I'm in favor of empowering the creators that way, and instead of you need to have 24 of these, you know.
It's true.
There's something to that, Jeff, but that model has had profound economic implications for the current Hollywood environment, right? Where people, like it used to be, you could get a job on ER and have consistent work for years and years and years and years. Like, and not just the actors, like everyone, all the hundreds of people involved. And now that has gone away. And Hollywood has really, the economy has really suffered. People have had to find other jobs and stuff. So I agree with you, Jeff. I agree. I'm not saying we should never make a show like Severance that takes 3 years to I just wish it wasn't 80 to 90% of the shows. You know, like I wish there was still a lot of shows that are extremely high quality that they're making 22 of each year. And
I was honestly flabbergasted that they launched the season two trailer. It felt like just a few months after.
Incredible.
One. I was like, whoa. Incredible. Wow. Is this the 90s again? Am I back to just it's consistent beautiful. Television every week? Every week, yeah.
It's beautiful. So anyway, understand, like, it's not like shows like Severance, right, or House of the Dragon or whatever are bad. Mm-hmm. It's just I just wish it wasn't most of what we're getting these days in terms of the high-quality shows. So anyway, The Pit. I rest my case.
You know?
I've said what I said. I really think this show needs support, and people should check it out. So, The Pit. And those are our thoughts on the Emmy Awards this year. Let's take a break for a sponsor. We'll be back with what we've been watching and a film court right after this. This week's episode is brought to you by LinkedIn Jobs. As a small business owner, you don't have the luxury of clocking out early. Your business is on your mind 24/7. So when you're hiring, you need a partner that works just as hard as you do. That hiring partner is LinkedIn Jobs. When you clock out, LinkedIn clocks in. LinkedIn makes it easy to post your job for free, share it with your network, and get qualified candidates that you can manage all in one place. Now, I've hired people for jobs before, and I've used LinkedIn in the process, and I've had a great experience. We all know LinkedIn is the place where people post their jobs, where people look for jobs, and it's super easy to use. Here's how it works. You can post your job with LinkedIn's new feature. You can write your job descriptions and quickly get your job in front of the right people with deep candidate insights. You can post your job for free or paid to promote. Promoted jobs get 3 times more qualified applicants. At the end of the day, the most important thing to your small business is the quality of candidates, and with LinkedIn, you can feel confident you're getting the best. Based on LinkedIn's data, 72% of small to medium-sized businesses using LinkedIn say that LinkedIn helped them find high-quality candidates. Let your network know you're hiring. You can even add a hashtag hiring frame to your profile picture and get 2 times more qualified candidates. Find out why more than 2.5 million small businesses use LinkedIn for hiring today. Find your next great hire on LinkedIn. And for listeners, we got a deal for you. Post your job for free at linkedin.com/filmcast. That's linkedin.com/filmcast to post your job for free. Terms and conditions apply. Thanks to LinkedIn Jobs for sponsoring us this week. All right, folks, it's time to don our robes, put on our wigs, and step into the Slash Film Court.
Slash Film Court.
Slash Film Court.
The Slash Film Court is the semi-regular segment where we adjudicate your movie-related dilemmas. And today I got a dilemma for you guys that we have talked about some version of this in the past, but I think it's kind of an interesting one. Because this is a scenario that may arise in some movies that we watch. Okay, this one comes in from Sam in British Columbia. Sam writes into slashfilmcast@gmail.com. First time, a longtime listener from the earliest years of the podcast. Love the show. Thank you so much for your dedication. My question is about the etiquette of crying during a film. I saw a movie. I'm not even gonna say what movie this is, because I don't think it's important. And I don't want people to accuse me of spoiling the movie. I saw a movie on Friday night, opening weekend. This movie is obviously a very intense movie. And a lady sitting behind me with her friend was sniffling and gasping throughout the first 2 acts. I had no problem with that. In fact, it made the movie feel more intense for me, knowing that others were sharing similar reactions. When the 3rd act got underway, she began sobbing. I'm talking uncontrollable weeping, blubbering, coughing, and occasional nose blowing. It did not let up until the very final moments of the film. I wasn't distracted. In fact, it made the movie feel even more intense for me, although I must admit I've never heard anyone cry so much in public before. When the credits rolled, a man sitting 2 rows down, so farther away from the weeping lady than me, came and angrily confronted her for ruining the experience for everyone else in the theater. She was still crying, so her friend told
him
to leave.
That's exactly what you should do to a crying woman.
Yeah. Her friends told him to leave, and she eventually did. I feel like the guy missed the point of the movie and shouldn't have rebuked her for crying so much. But then again, it clearly distracted him. Judges, what say you? P.S. Yes, I go see horror movies by myself, but that's not on trial here. End quote. First of all, there's nothing wrong with going to see a movie by yourself. Yeah. In fact,
no, it's the best.
It can be one of the best ways to see a movie. So no.
There's a whole societal stigma against it. Like outside of movie people, they think you're weird for doing it.
You know? Really?
Yeah.
I've never encountered
it's
that.
It's a total thing. It's very much a thing.
There's a famous Onion story about it. What is it? It was like strange loser going to see movies all by himself. Like that's the headline
it's
of the
story
article.
Of my life. That's yeah. Right, I used to go right. When back in the old days, I used to go. My tradition was I would go to the movies by myself on Christmas Day. When I first moved into LA, I wouldn't go home.
Do you give your whole, like, you tell everybody you love, give middle fingers?
No, I didn't go home. We have a longstanding tradition where we celebrate Christmas the week before Christmas with my family. So everybody can go to the other sides of their families on actual Christmas. And before I was married I wasn't even doing the Totally Rad Show yet. I was just living in Los Angeles, living by myself. And so I didn't have a Christmas on Christmas, and my Christmas was I would go watch the Christmas Day movies, and I'd go early in the morning by myself, and I would go see a movie, and then I would sneak into a second movie. That was my little gift to myself.
So you're saying that Onion Story was about you, Jeff?
Maybe. I'm sorry. It was the best. I loved it so very much.
It is. Yeah. Yeah. So I miss those days. Yeah.
Devinder Hardwar, how do you rule on this
guy's
case?
An asshole. It's very simple. Guy's an asshole. It is unfortunate that somebody experiencing human emotion may distract you during a thing, but you know, that it happens. People are so, they don't know what to do with somebody crying in public. And I guess maybe I'm just like, I don't know. I'm used to living in cities where like people coexist and somebody may be sniffling. And what you do is either give them space, you kind of look at what's happening, or you're like, hey, do you need a tissue? Or just like give them a tissue or something. Like that's it. What do they need? They don't need to be rebuked for having an emotional response to a movie. So that's unfortunate.
Jeff Cannata, your thoughts on this film court case?
Yeah, this seems odd. I feel like we're missing some information here because this seems like a disproportionate response to a perfectly natural reaction in the context of watching a movie. If she's wailing, you know, if it's, I can understand that because I feel like you can control. I mean, there are ways to cry in a non-disruptive manner, you know. I don't know if that's the case here, but I think I am not in favor of the reaction that is inappropriate in the sense of like, you know, laughing during a sad scene or crying during there are ways to make an emotional response feel like a commentary. And I'm never a fan of that. I've definitely experienced that. Where people, you know, something happens and people are like, oh God, you know, that like we're in a society, we're all in a theater together, and you can have a emotional response. I often do. I cry all the time in movies, but I do think there's a way to do it in a manner that is consistent with the vibe of the room. That said, nothing that we've learned from this email seems to indicate that's what happened. So I kind of tend to agree with Devendra that this feels like a guy who is a jerk, but I wonder if there was some other aspect of it that maybe hasn't been revealed.
Was it a quiet movie? Like I would love to know what kind of movie it was.
Yeah, I mean, there are ways to cry that are obnoxious for sure. Yes. I'm not going to argue with that. Yeah.
It may or may not be a movie we are reviewing this week on the podcast. Okay. So may or may not. You know,
why hide that?
People are so sensitive these days.
Just to make Flash Film Court more complicated. Absolutely. I'm going to remove key pieces of context and information.
Absolutely. So anyway, I agree with you guys. And Jeff, I think that's really well said about sometimes people can have an emotional reaction that feels opposed or like diametrically opposed to what the movie is trying to evoke. Mm-hmm. And that feels weird. It is really hard for me to see somebody crying in this situation and feel like they are acting inappropriately.
Yeah, because this is a sad movie.
Yeah.
If
it were about the movie we were talking about this week, it would be extremely understandable.
It would be really easy to look at this movie and see parallels to modern life and being like, oh man, we're fucked, aren't we? Huh. I'd wail for that. Yeah.
So... but not only that, Devendra, just like the idea of, some movies can evoke feelings and thoughts about losing those you love or connections with those you love and so on and so forth, that can make people very emotional. And so I do think that it is fine in general for people to show emotion. Now, here's the thing. You know what I was thinking? I was interrogating myself about this, and it's like, I don't know if I'd feel the same way about laughing at a movie, because I think that like it's possible to taken to the extreme, you can start to impact the like. But I don't even know if that's true. I think if you're going to the Naked Gun and people are laughing really hard, I think that's probably fine. Like I think.
You're not Robert De Niro in Cape Fear, right?
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. It's like the Robert De Niro in Cape Fear is the kind of canonical. Yeah. Example of like somebody, that person is the problem, right?
And well, there are people who are weirdly performative in the context of a filled theater, where they they want you to hear their reaction, oddly. Yes. I've certainly experienced that.
For repertory screenings, that tends to happen. People who've seen the movie 1,000 times, and they're like, oh, we've all seen this. We've seen Heat 100 times. Let's all laugh at every time Pacino says something, which was the experience I had one time when I went to see Heat. So it was not fun.
Yeah, I agree. So I want to make space for condemning those people, basically.
Yeah, right? Yes.
I want to make sure we're able to, whatever we say today doesn't mean we can't also be against that. But it's a fine needle to thread.
Yeah.
And I do think someone being profoundly moved by a movie should be, in general, okay.
I'm not surprised that a guy is aggressively angry about somebody expressing emotion. Like, this movie is so much about that sort of thing, too.
I do think it's one thing to be, it's one thing to, for us to say on the show, oh, hey, this woman is guilty and she shouldn't have done that. We're not saying that at all, but I'm saying we could say that. It's another thing to then for a guy to go up to her and then rebuke her for it. Maybe well, they listen. Maybe they listened to the film court from last time.
Yeah,
and they took it too seriously. Where we said you should go up to people and tell them that.
So. Yeah,
man, we need to really split some hairs up in here.
Yeah, he is a film court listener. That's the problem.
Yeah. That's why I feel like maybe there's some missing detail here because the only way this seems plausible to, I mean, other than the fact that people are just jerks, but the only way this feels plausible is if she's being demonstrative in some way that is disproportionate. You know, if it's, you know, if it's some kind of wail. I don't know. But I can understand being like, come on, lady.
What if she was wailing, though, Jeff? Right? What if the movie moved her that much that she was wailing?
I mean, I still think that's probably okay. Yeah. But, you know, I think that's one where it's like, can you understand? The line that I always want to say to people and often do is, you know you're not at home, right?
Sure.
You know you're not at home.
Yeah,
you are out in public right now, and I think there's a lot of people that behave in a way.
I like that all of Jeff's line to people at movies are like somehow passive aggressive in some way.
Right? I find it effective.
Yeah.
The way there used to be a difference between how you behave out in public and how you behave in the comfort of your own home.
That is true. That line has dissolved
100%
in the post-COVID era, right? Like that line has started to dissolve, and it is a very terrifying thing. By the way, I do just want to acknowledge on the last film court, we talked about a situation where somebody brought a baby to a screening, and then the next time they went to a movie, the same couple brought a baby.
Do we have an update?
No update, but somebody in the Patreon, I'm sorry, I forget who it was. I want to say it's Chris. I'm not sure if that's true. I apologize if I got your name wrong. But somebody gave the really good advice, which is because we had said, hey, these people might actually be your friends because they go to the same movies. The problem is they're bringing a baby to the screening. And this person on the Patreon suggested you should go up to that person and say, start talking to them and then say, man, I can't, you won't believe this story. I went to a screening last time and some asshole brought a baby.
It doesn't work because they're there with the baby. The baby.
You need to isolate them from the baby and then tell the story. And then, you know, like somehow.
That's funny.
But yeah, that would be good. That'll be a way of communicating your displeasure without necessarily condemning them.
You know, they do other
them.
Of these kind of retro screenings. I went to one last week. Oh, it was ruined though. That's pretty funny.
Yeah.
See, man, you mock, but passive aggression is the way to go.
Yeah, I mean, it has its uses, Jeff. I'm not saying it's ineffective.
It depends on the situation. Depends.
To quote the Big Lebowski, I'm not saying you're wrong. I'm saying you're an asshole. Or to paraphrase, I don't know if that's the exact quote, but anyway, you're not wrong, Walter. You're an asshole. I think this is what it says. But anyway. Okay, so to close this case, woman not guilty, guy who went up and harassed her probably guilty. We don't know what the full situation is, but that is our ruling here on the film court today. If you want to let us know your movie-related dilemmas, you can always email into us at slashfilmcast@gmail.com. All right, folks, it's time to get to what we've been watching this week. Jeff Cannata, hit us up with something you've been watching this week. We talked about covering this as a main review, but I think we decided not to, but I still want to hear your thoughts.
Yeah, I was pretty amazed to see that they finally got around to making a sequel to This Is Spinal Tap. And it made me revisit the original film, This Is Spinal Tap, from 1984, which is a movie that I loved as a kid, but it's been 35 years since I've seen it. This is not one that I feel like the Christopher Guest pattern. Obviously, this is not, you know, his direction, but it feels like it spawned all of those mockumentaries. This is Spinal Tap was the progenitor, but not my favorite. I feel like, you know, Best in Show and
Mighty Wind.
Waiting for Guffman is my favorite. Waiting for Guffman is my favorite, and then Best in Show. And I feel like maybe in order of release they get sort of worse. But you know, Spinal Tap is the one that started it all, and certainly is a movie that I loved and still use. You know, this one goes to 11, or these go to 11 to this day. Right, that is one of the great comedic moments in film history, right? It is in the pantheon.
Iconic.
Completely. It is an amazing, and so useful in everyday life.
Yes.
I use it all the time. So, you know, Spinal Tap is close to my heart, but again, not a movie I revisit or have revisited like I have with Guffman, which Guffman I've seen, I don't know, man, a lot, many times. And always delight in showing new people. So it was fun to revisit This Is Spinal Tap in anticipation of Spinal Tap 2, The End Continues. And I was reminded how freaking dry this movie is. It is not, even comparing it to later Christopher Guest movies, which have real jokes and comedic premises, you know, have real bits in them. There aren't really bits in Spinal Tap.
Mm-hmm.
There's a few, but they are most of this movie is really trying to be an sort of pseudo authentic look at ridiculous humans. It's like, it's a send up of how ridiculous the hairband phenomenon is. And it is making fun of these particular guys in that it is showing that they were always doing the trend, right? They were the Beatles knockoff band first, and then they were the like 1960s like pieces. The song "The Flower People," you know, is a knockoff of that trendy thing with, you know, the Mamas and the Papas kind of ripoff. And now it's the 80s, so of course they're doing, you know, hardcore heavy metal rock and roll. So it's a send up of sort of inauthentic people and, you know, opportunistic people and ridiculous morons, really. But it doesn't tip over into absurdity as often as the later Christopher Guest movies do, right? Those people are absurd often, right? And much of the comedy is gleaned from that. But in Spinal Tap, it's a much subtler comedy. And so I really think people who would visit that movie now would find it sort of slow and we are inundated with the things that were inspired by This Is Spinal Tap.
Right.
And everything kind of took it farther. And I think that moved the line. And so in revisiting it, I'm reminded, wow, this is really a much tamer movie than I recall it being. You know, there's a few goofy bits, you know, the Stonehenge being, he writes it in inches on the napkin instead of feet. And so it's this big instead of being a set piece. And like there are bits, but they're fewer and farther between. And really the best stuff, I think, other than obviously This Goes to 11, and those moments. The best stuff from Spinal Tap are the songs, right? The songs are really funny. And particularly, you know, there's a song, about, you know, a woman's derriere and its size. And the chorus is, how, you know, how could I leave this behind? Right. That's hilarious, in my opinion. How could I leave this behind? And you know,
classic Jeff.
Classic. Now, I mean, it's,
this is where all your humor is derived from. Is this?
These are my comic sensibilities. This is, you know, so you know, it's super inappropriate. The kinds of people they are, you know, but it's all a put on, right? They are not authentically these rock and rollers. They're just leaping on a trend. So anyway, I'm, you know, Dave, you said you've never seen this movie. Having rewatched it now, I hesitate even to urge you to watch it. Like before I'd rewatched it, I was like, oh, you have to see Spy. But even now it's like, I don't think it lands the way it did in the 80s because the environment is different, right? The context is different. And it is
like
it is
everything we're seeing of this ilk is now so over the top.
Yes.
Right. That these guys feel very muted in comparison. Right.
Well said. Yes.
Yeah. I mean, look at The Office. Look at like all the mockumentary shows. Like they're just everywhere right now. But I rewatched it recently too, Jeff, and it reminds me a lot of like the British Office, like where it was really dry and subdued. You had some like crazy characters, but it was a really slow show compared to the American Office or what that turned into. Yeah.
But even The Office UK had the kind of cringe aspect that, you know, from what I know of Spinal Tap, you know, there is some of that, but it's that's not the main event.
No, it is not the main event. Yeah. No,
it's like the beginning of like the Curb Your Enthusiasm thing too. Just like, look at these idiots and people like trying to like make sense of their stupidity. Like that is, I get that same vibe.
Yeah.
All right. So this is Spinal Tap. Beautifully said, Jeff, beautifully recounted. And so I am so curious, what was it like to see the sequel to this movie in theaters this week?
Well, I'll tell you, I went to a Friday night sort of primetime screening, and I was the only person in the theater.
Oh, man.
Brutal.
I do not think this is going to make – I think this sequel is several decades too late. and it certainly could be called Spinal Tap 2, The Ravages of Time, because – it is, you know, everybody, you know, Christopher Guest, Harry Shearer, what's the other guy's name? I should have it in front of me, and I do not. Lenny and Squiggy. He's awesome. He was in Better Call Saul, the brother.
Yeah,
What's the actor's name? Yeah.
I think you're thinking of Christopher McKean. Is that right?
Yeah.
McKean.
Yeah, McKean. Yeah.
Michael McKean.
Michael McKean.
I was mixing that with Christopher Guest.
Yeah. Michael McKean. Yes. Great. I love him. Name escaped me. I should have the IMDb in front of me and I don't. It's wonderful to see them. They are all, you know, getting up there, right? Getting up there.
Yeah.
And they put the wigs back on to have the long rocker hair. But you know, these are older dudes and so you definitely, especially having watched it back to back, it's pretty clear how much time has passed and how you know, age is a brutal mistress. Rob Reiner, of course, also back as the documentarian Marty DeBurgi, which I always thought was a funny name too. All the names are funny in Spinal Tap. Man, I liked the experience of watching this movie in that it's just, I just like watching these guys revisit these characters. And, you know, we meet Nigel, who is the Christopher Guest character. He's now been working, he founded a cheese and guitar shop, you know, where they sell cheese and guitars, and sometimes they'll trade one for the other, you know? And yeah, so there's ridiculous stuff, but you know, the conceit of this movie is that they're getting the band back together for a farewell tour in their old age. And, you know, it does not hit the highs that the best of the Christopher Guest movies do. But I will tell you, there are some cameos in this movie that are among the most potent cameos you would ever be able to line up. They mm-hmm. are, if you're looking for cameos, these are home runs of cameos. And they're not 4-second cameos. They're beefy, lengthy, in it to win it cameos. And it's pretty amazing to see the people that show up in this movie. Also, the original This Is Spinal Tap had you know, people who weren't big deals at their time, like David Letterman's Paul, what is his name? The guy who was David Letterman's musical guy mm-hmm. for years. Anyway, he is like, everybody's back. Like, they got
Paul Schaefer.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Did I mention I ran a half marathon yesterday? My brain is not working. Paul Schaefer is back. The nanny is back.
Fran Drescher is amazing.
Fran Drescher. Yeah.
Yeah. So
they get everybody. The only person that was in the first one for like half a second that isn't in this one is Billy Crystal. But mm-hmm. it's fun to just see all these people reprising these roles. It's fun to see the big, huge cameos. It's hard for me to recommend this movie to anybody who doesn't already really have an affection for the first Spinal Tap. This is not going to win you over and make you love it. Like, they play all the songs from the first movie in new ways. It really feels like a love letter to that first movie. There are moments where they flash back and show you footage from the first movie. It feels like this long overdue acknowledgement that this first film has a big place in the cultural zeitgeist, but it doesn't add much more to that. It's not mm-hmm. going to stand on its own. It just feels like member berries a bit, and some lovely nostalgia, some lovely revisiting of these situations. It's not a laugh riot. I would like to spoil, because I'm not recommending this to people, and I think most people aren't going to actually take the time to watch this movie, I would like to spoil my favorite joke from it, which actually happens in the end credits of the movie. So if you don't want to hear what I consider to be the best joke in the movie spoiled, skip forward 15, 30 seconds. But this is like an all-timer joke for me, in my opinion. So they're talking to Michael McKean, and he's like, well, what are you going to do next? It's the end of the movie. What are you going to do next? And he's like, well, I'm thinking of, you know, writing a memoir about my time in the band. He's like, I was inspired by Bruce Springsteen's memoir, I Am Springsteen Going on Spreventeen, which I think is one of the freaking funniest jokes ever written. I Am Springsteen Going on Spreventeen.
Jeff's just laughing to himself alone in that theater.
Dude,
cackling.
Alone.
Yeah, cackling.
He's a Robert De Niro in Cape Fear.
Yeah.
Cackling. That is so brilliant. I can't even, like, I could spend an hour to dissect that joke and just how beautiful it is. I Am Springsteen Going on Spreventeen. Oh, God damn it. Anyway, so there are, you know, there are not a lot of those moments in the sequel, but there were enough that tickled me. And again, you get to see these guys. These guys are actually very good musicians, right? They're mm-hmm. they're talented musicians. They were, The Mighty Wind, you got to see that on display as well. And they play the music, and they play it with some amazing people that I won't reveal, but I was shocked to see them show up, and not just show up to say howdy, but to like be in the movie. So I don't know. It's hard for me to recommend this to anybody that isn't already a sicko for Spinal Tap. And even then, you know, it really isn't a huge hit, isn't a huge home run. It's just, you know, fun.
Better or worse than Happy Gilmore 2, Jeff Cannata?
I think it's better, but I was reminded of that movie, which yeah, feels like the same energy of like, right. Hey, remember all this stuff? And hey, isn't that first movie great? And
right, they're showing clips from the first movie as well, right?
Yeah, isn't it great to see Ben Stiller in the same old getup? You know, it's like all these folks. Isn't it great to see these people in the same old getup doing the same old stuff? Wasn't it? They're still around, and look, they can still do the thing. And that's really the joy of this one. That's the most joy you'll get out of it, I think.
Well, that's Jeff Cannata's thoughts on Spinal Tap 2. The End Continues. We're going to take another break for a sponsor. We'll be back with more what we've been watching right after this. Okay, so, you know, there actually was one other major film news story that we should have gotten to.
Okay.
And it's my bad for not bringing it up, but it is the weekend box office. Devendra, I'm really curious. You're the resident anime expert on here, right? Demon Slayer Kimetsu no Yaiba Infinity Castle.
That is that. Yeah, I'm not surprised that did well.
Is a movie that played in theaters this weekend. It made $70 million.
In
it
one week?
It may end up grossing more than Fantastic Four First Steps.
Good God.
And this is a movie that, for those who don't know, according to Wikipedia, is a direct sequel to the fourth season of the anime television series, as well as the manga fourth, fifth, and sixth adaptations following the film Mugen Train and the feature-length compilations to the Swordsmith Village and to the Hashira Training, end quote.
What a time to be an anime. Like, these kids don't know how lucky they have it. Man.
You need to be... this feels as complicated, if not more, than the MCU.
It's not that bad. You watch you don't have to watch the anime and the manga. It's just TV show and the comic. You watch the anime. You watch the other movie and the other... you watch the thing. I watched some of Demon Slayer. It seems fine. It also seems like we're just doing like the same types of things again and again. Like, I grew up watching Dragon Ball and Rurouni Kenshin, all those, and Demon Slayer has a lot of those. But the fact that it made so much money... Like, my brother went to see it in the theater this week. I'm not caught up, otherwise I would too. The fact that there's anime in the theaters, new anime in the theaters, is wild. Right. They're also doing the Perfect Blue remaster is going to be in theaters, I think, in a couple weeks or months, and I am totally going to do that. So it's great. It's great to see it because, guys, I don't know how far you used to have to go to get your media, but I used to have to fill out a personal check, mail it to some website on the internet, and I would receive back a third or fourth generation VHS copy of a copy of a fan sub, not even a professional sub, but fans who love this thing so much took the time to hard code subtitles themselves.
Wow, like they burned it in themselves.
That's how you did it, because that's how we survived. They didn't bring over everything, so fans would translate it, fans would time it and sub it, and
incredible.
The only way to get media was by VHS in the mail. This was pre-DVD and everything. So now you could just walk into the theater and get your anime. Just wild.
Yeah, and not only can you, people are doing it in droves, which is astonishing. So shout out to that movie. And also, wow, like that movie made... It's astonishing that it could outgross a Marvel film, right? Like that is just like...
I was standing lonely outside my... screening room for Spinal Tap 2 and
which
watching
made $1.6 million this weekend, by the way.
Yeah. I think I was the 0.6 of that. And I was standing there watching the IMAX down the hall, people stream in to see this.
Yeah, to see Demon Slayer. Yeah.
Yeah.
Incredible. Catch up.
Incredible. Yeah. Okay. Devendra Hardwar and I both had a chance to watch a movie that is out in theaters right now. It is called Twinless, and this movie won the Audience Award at Sundance, and the extremely short version of what the movie's about, where I'll try to be as vague as possible, right, but it's essentially about what happens when two people meet at a support group for people who have lost their twin, right? So you people who have twin, but their twin has died, and there's a support group for people who, like, meet together, talk about the grief about having a twin, like being twinless, essentially. And Devendra Hardwar, what did you think of this movie, Twinless?
Fascinating. Like, this movie goes places I did not quite expect. I think that initial setup is interesting. Like, what does a twin do? How do they feel? How do they navigate the world having lost a person who was like their other half, who they grew up with, who was always in their lives? How do you define your identity when your identity was part of a pair, you know? And I think that alone is compelling. And then this movie goes places that are really interesting, maybe a little melodramatic, I think. But the performances are amazing. Dylan O'Brien, an actor I've not really thought of much very much before. Like, he was in the Maze Runner films. He's been in all sorts of TV shows. He plays dual roles in this movie and kind of does an amazing transformation of these twins, of how like polar opposite they are. That's fantastic. And also James Sweeney, the writer director, is in this movie too. And he's a fascinating freak. Like, he plays this guy as just like that sort of awkward person in your office who like, nobody really wants to be friends with. And they're always kind of like, but they want friendship. They want connection. This is very much a movie about how hard it is to make connections and make friends, especially with guys. Like, it's tough for adult men to even have that. So there's a lot going on here. I think it does lean into melodrama maybe sometimes. I think Lauren Graham is in this movie as Dylan O'Brien's mom. She has kind of a thankless role, I think, just because it's mostly just shouting. But also that feels really very real to maybe something James Sweeney is familiar with in his experience. So I really enjoyed this. The weird thing I was thinking of, Dave, is this really reminds me of like 6 Feet Under. The sort of way 6 Feet Under would, in a single episode or season, explore questions of life and death, but also sexuality and friendship and relationships. Like, it's all of that kind of combined in one thing. It is fascinating. Jeff, I think you'd love this movie. Yeah,
I certainly love 6 Feet Under.
Yeah, I overall also recommend this movie. The reason to recommend this movie, in my opinion, is Dylan O'Brien is astonishing in this film. It is incredible what he does in this movie. And for that reason, just to see an actor doing something that's just stretching themselves and really accomplishing something that is rare, I think it's worth recommending Twinless for that reason alone. The movie is very watchable. The problem is, for me, one of the characters, who I'm not going to say who it is, engages in activities that, in my opinion, are so morally reprehensible.
They're a stalker.
That it is difficult for me to really be emotionally invested. The movie is not endorsing those actions. The movie's not saying like that person is a good person or anything. But it's difficult because you need, in my opinion, you need the person. Like the audience needs to either identify the person or in some way be rooting for them. And that's true for shows like The Sopranos and Breaking Bad. You know, like, people root for those people, even though those people are horrible. And this person's did some things that were just like really pretty rough and made it difficult for me to therefore invest in the outcome. That said, I did think that, just Dylan O'Brien's work is admirable and worth mentioning. So
I hear what you're saying. I think what that person does is weird, and that makes it interesting in a way, because we've all met these sorts of people who maybe don't have the social graces to know when to how to really make connections, or when they're going overboard or something. There is a bit of like stalker syndrome in here. But it also feels very real and genuine, because it's not coming out of like some sort of pathology. It's coming out of a need for connection.
Maybe a pathology as well. But
Only
other thing I want to say about this is this movie takes place in Portland, and then the characters do visit Seattle.
They do drive to Seattle.
I do think it is a very unrealistic depiction of Seattle. I'm just going to put it that way.
You don't think they really went to a Seattle hockey stadium and parking garage?
That's true. So
it could be anywhere. They could have gone anywhere.
That part is accurate. But essentially, this is a very minor spoiler for the movie. So like, flip forward. But they encounter a very bigoted character in Seattle. And that just has not been my
really.
I'm sure those people exist in certainly in Washington State. They exist. But in Seattle, if you are a bigot in general, you are the one that needs to be afraid.
Well, the way I would explain that is they were going to a hockey game.
Yeah,
people
sure.
come in from all over.
That's fair.
And
that's
often
fair.
It's people out of towners coming in and like not gelling with the culture. So
that's true. That's true. So yeah. I'm not saying there are zero bigots in Seattle. And you're right, Devinger. Like that is an event that might bring in people that would be of that persuasion. But I would say in general, Seattle is extremely welcoming to all kinds of weird people, present company included.
Isn't Seattle the town that literally has a phrase for how unfriendly it is?
Vindra,
it's called the Seattle. We will not be your friend.
Yeah, that's
but
right.
We will not be bigoted.
But people leave you the fuck alone. Like that's the thing. Like they don't. You can do what you can dress. You can leave your house dressed in all kinds of random shit. Like no one gives a shit. Like that's that is both the beauty and the problem. With Seattle, in my opinion.
I mean, so. I hear that, but also the level of bigotry they face in that particular meeting, I saw it happen at our college campus, which is one of the most like liberal, accepting places.
No, it's fair.
You know,
it's
like
fair.
It happens.
Yeah, I agree.
People suck.
I agree with you. Okay, so maybe it's not unrealistic. Let's just put it this way: very few scenes happen in Seattle, and like that's one of the things that happens in Seattle. And so it kind of. It rubbed you the wrong way. It rubbed me the wrong way a little bit, but hey, I'm not saying people have never experienced those things in Seattle. I don't feel like it is the predominant experience, but you know, I could be wrong. Okay. The movie is Twinless. It's in theaters right now. Devinder and I both recommend it. You should check it out. All right. That's going to bring us to the end of what we've been watching this week. It's time to get to our weekly plugs. Weekly plugs, the part of the show each week where we plug something else we've been making. This week, I want to throw a shout out to a couple things. First of all, over at decodingeverything.com, my free newsletter, Stephen David Miller is publishing his reactions to TIFF. He's seen a lot of movies. He's seen Hamlet. He's seen Hamnet. He's seen Nuremberg.
He's gone to all the festivals. Man.
All the hams.
He saw Smashing Machine. So if you want to read one of the first reviews ever written about those movies, go to decodingeverything.com, check out his dispatches. I also do want to throw a shout out to Decoding TV, where Miles McDutt and I are two of the only sickos we know to watch the Emmys all the way through. We broadcast about it right afterwards, talked about our feelings. Check it out at Decoding TV on our YouTube as well as the podcast over there. Devinder Hardaway, your weekly plug.
Yeah, well, last week was Apple News Week, you know, so that's a busy time for me. I want to shout out the Engadget podcast where we broke down everything about the iPhone 17 and everything else Apple announced. I've already pre-ordered the AirPods Pro 3 for the new Apple Watch, so I'm
excited, hoping, man. Looking,
yeah, they
look good. Could have used them today, I'm not going to lie, when I was awoken by the sound of a tree being fed into a chipper, you know, but...
Gotta love it. I also wrote a piece about why Apple's new square selfie cameras, the front cameras, are kind of a big deal and kind of interesting. And it's hard to remember, like, there used to be a time before fast cell phone networks and decent smartphones where you did not have a good front-facing camera, and how much has changed the way we interact with technology, the way we take photos and videos. So wrote a bit about that. Also wrote about that NVIDIA's GeForce Now has been upgraded with RTX 5080 graphics, and it's good. It's great. Like, game streaming with a crazy powerful GPU, I think for a lot of people, it may be something to consider. Go check out that piece.
Thank you, Devinder. Hey, guys, I had a question for you. This is considered a rhetorical one, but did you know that Stephen King has a son named Joe? That Stephen King has a son named Joe?
Is it you?
Jeff Cannata, what's your weekly plug?
Speaking of video games, I do a video game podcast. It's called DLC. I think this week's was particularly good. We had a great guest, Lucy James from GameSpot and lots of other places came on. Again, she's a delight. And we talked about Borderlands 4 and Hell Is Us and Nintendo's huge Direct, where they had tons of Super Mario Brothers 40th anniversary announcements, including the return of the Virtual Boy, which is bonkers. All kinds of good stuff. Check it out. It's episode 617 of DLC. You can find it at dlcpod.com.
I want to throw a shout out for our Patreon page at patreon.com/filmpodcast, where you can get ad-free episodes as well as early access episodes, as well as exclusive bonus episodes where we talk about what's going on in our lives. We do an occasional review like we recently did of Akira Kurosawa's High and Low. Patreon.com/filmpodcast. Of course, we never want anyone to donate. If it in any way causes them financial hardship, you can always support us for free by leaving a star rating for us on Apple Podcasts or sharing the podcast. Share our reviews, which we publish at YouTube at youtube.com/@thefilmcastpod. Thanks to everyone who helps to keep this podcast going. Let's get to our review of The Long Walk.
They say you shouldn't make friends on The Long Walk, but I sort of like you three. Let's be musketeers. Off one!
One for all.
Nah, and again, I need to hear it louder. Off one!
And one for all!
The only guarantee you have as a human being is that you are going to die. And if you're lucky, you get to choose how you spend those last moments.
Welcome to the Filmcast review of The Long Walk. I'm going to read the plot summary from IMDb. A group of teenage boys compete in an annual contest known as The Long Walk, where they must maintain a certain walking speed or get shot, end quote. Devinder Hardware, I think you're one of the biggest Francis Lawrence fans on this podcast.
Oh, yeah.
You've been rooting for a reevaluation of Constantine this whole time.
Which we did, and we liked.
It was great. It was great to talk about that movie again on the After Dark. Obviously, I Am Legend, really
the
great
Hunger
movie.
Games movies.
Hunger Games movies. All right, so Devinder Hardware. All that said, what did you think of Francis Lawrence taking on a Stephen King novel in The Long Walk?
I think this is one of the best Stephen King adaptations of all time. I think this movie is incredible. I have not read the book, but I kind of get the gist of it. And just the trailer for this thing was so evocative. It also felt like something that Francis Lawrence would kind of get a handle on, because his Hunger Games movies, say what you will about the quality of the books and like the source material and everything, I like those books. He certainly got the energy of young people trying to exist and resist in a fascist state, essentially. And this is a very similar thing in so many ways. So, yeah, I think this movie, it's not a really showy directorial thing, but it does lean into like some great performances. Cooper Hoffman's great. David Johnson, who we saw in Alien Romulus, who is from industry. I love him as an actor. This is like star making material for him here. I hope he has a very long career. I like the concept. I love the setup. It feels a little bit like Battle Royale in terms of like how they sketch out how wider society exists and why this weird thing is happening. I love everything about this movie, and I can understand, if this was the movie in the Slash Film Court case, why somebody would be wailing at the end. Like, I think it's genuinely moving, emotional, relevant to kind of what we're going through right now. And also something that kind of speaks to how we survive and how we move forward, because especially after last week where shit has seemed to go extra topsy turvy. I feel like we need that. I feel like we need to really center on the things that will help us get forward, especially, you know, while trying to exist in a fascist society, which we effectively do now, at least in America and a lot of other countries around the world. So I found this movie to be fascinating, timely, well executed. Do want to point out, the script was written by J.T. Mulner, who did that movie Strange Darling that we talked about a couple of years ago.
That I liked, and a lot of people didn't like.
No, a lot of people liked. I specifically was just like, that was a movie that lost me with the title card. This movie was shot on film, just so you know.
And it all went downhill from there.
But I think like he is an effective writer. I think when he's not trying to be so showy, you know, I feel like Strange Darling was a thing to say, look what I can do. And this movie, this script, the structure of it is a very reserved, very patient thing, and I think it's that's remarkable as well. So
I would describe it as very competent. I mean, these characters that you meet, they all are they all have like a characteristic that you can remember them by. Buy the relationships between them. They have great chemistry, and in particular Cooper Hoffman and David Johnson, I think they're really the people that hold the movie together, and you really need to believe that they have this rapport, and you do. And so that part of the movie really works. So anyway, Devendra is a huge fan of The Long Walk. Jeff Cannata, what about you?
Well, Dave, I guess you could say what I thought about The Long Walk is best summed up in the form of a limerick.
Let's hear it.
These walkers, it wants me to mourn, but all I can feel is scorn. For a movie so pat, every moment falls flat. It's nothing but misery porn.
Ooh.
This is going to be a hard episode because I can't recall a movie I've hated as much as this movie.
Good God.
I loathed this movie. It gives me no pleasure to say that. I'm glad. I feel this is going to be probably one of those movies that comes up at the end of the year for a movie I didn't get.
Right.
Because it seems like so many people liked it. And I have no idea what movie Devendra or anybody else was watching. Every single thing in this movie I thought was the dumbest version of what I'm watching. And we can get into details and spoilers if we want to, or I could just sit back and let you guys talk about a movie you liked, and that's fine too. But I thought this was as predictable as could possibly be. There are things that are played like reveals that like, what, how could you not think that would happen? I don't buy any of the relationships. I would urge people to watch a documentary I've talked about called Just One Mile, which does this concept for real and is better.
I get it, Jeff. Like, you know what a long walk is. You, in fact, know what a long run is. So you're
I did
not
one
true life
yesterday. And I will tell you, nothing plays out the way it plays out in this movie. Like, I don't believe
inaccurate.
For a freaking second that these people have any experience doing an endurance event. Maybe I'm wrong, but the movie certainly doesn't convey any kind of sense of authenticity of how that would go down. And it also, it feels like like I said in the limerick, it feels like the most pat version of all of these sort of emotional beats. It feels manipulative to me, for the audience. And I resented it from the word go. And I was absolutely furious at the ending, which we can talk about.
Well, at least I think we'll agree on Strange Darling, Jeff. Like, I think like the formula of whatever this guy, JT Mulner, is doing rubs us the wrong way sometimes.
I mean, I don't know how much we want to get into specifics, not in spoilers. I can talk about the beginning of the movie, but we don't need to. I can also just shut up and let Dave talk about how much he liked it. Because, there is very little I found to be redeeming. I do think, you know, the young actors that they hired, I like all of them. I also really like Mark Hamill. Usually I just found the material. I also, here's what I'll say that's positive. It is no small feat to shoot a movie where everyone is moving constantly.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That's gotta be hard.
And in long continuous takes usually.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. So just logistically, it's impressive that they pulled this off.
I also feel like the timing of this like day is actually you can't do night for day here easily. You kind of have to do it.
Yeah. They did. It seemed like they did night for night in this one.
Yeah.
So I will say that, that is laudable and really cool. Like, I don't think I've ever seen a movie that just sort of structurally is this of being one long camera move, you know, just a long ass camera move constantly. You know, obviously not one take, but that's impressive. And it's cool to see that on a technical level, but literally every other aspect of it, I found to be insultingly bad.
Well, Jeff, as you probably could already tell from how I reacted to Devendra's review, I really liked The Long Walk. I thought, this was really, really well done. And it comes down to just two components. As I've already indicated, the relationships between the characters, I really bought. I mean, Devendra, you and I bonded in college over Battle Royale. And this is very similar to Battle Royale, right? It's this kind of dystopian future. Kids are forced to compete until there's only one left. And along the way, we invest in them and their lives and their relationships with each other and what they're trying to do this for, what they're trying to survive for. And so I think that's just an inherently compelling story, and therefore I liked how this movie is structured. There are some things I did not like about the film. did not like the ending. And some of the things the movie that happened in the movie are very maudlin and kind of ridiculous from a plot perspective. We'll talk about that in spoilers. But overall, I was a fan of how this is structured. And then the second part is you can read this movie as an allegory for many things. You know, you can I actually really appreciate the world building in this. It takes place in an alternate sort of alternate history, like alternate timeline, right? I think it's meant to be kind of in the post-World War II era, right? But what if like it played out in a different fashion?
It's, the idea is that set in the time period that Stephen King loves, which is his youth.
Yeah. And the idea is that they are, these kids are marching not only so that they can attain a prize, but for the glory of the country, right? That there is something that's, there is something very kind of propagandistic about the way that this whole long walk is being used. And I really loved the world building in this movie. I thought it's very, very subtle. You know, Jeff, in recent weeks, we have praised how economical some scripts are, like Superman, right? Like, I think, I think we really loved how economical Superman was in conveying a lot. Well, there was another movie recently we discussed that was also similarly economical, right? But, yeah, I was a huge fan of how economical the script is. That you essentially never really leave. Maybe it was weapons, Jeff, by the way.
Might have been weapons.
Might have been weapons is what we're talking about. But maybe, but you never really like leave this group of kids. Like you never really, it never really cuts to an outside perspective. And yet despite that, through just the conversation between them, we have an understanding of what the rules of this game are, how it's been played in the past, what its function is in our society. And I just found that all to be really, really effective. But in my opinion, you know, and I know people read this differently, like it's a, it's an allegory for American capitalism and how, we exist in a system that's ostensibly voluntary, but that grinds you to dust and you know, like dangles this carrot of your wildest dreams and making a lot of money, but in the process grinds you to dust. And I just think that's a really relevant fable for our current era. So I was a huge fan of The Long Walk. I'm sorry you didn't like it, Jeff, but we can talk a little bit about some of the stuff that didn't work in the spoilers. Anything else we want to mention before we get there, though? I think
I also found it to be very unpleasant most of the time, like that the things you see are just like there's lots of graphic pooping and lots of graphic violence.
They explain, you know, one of the questions you might have,
you gotta poop
watching this movie, is how are they going to handle their bodily functions? And they
it
do
seems like a legitimate question.
They do address it, which I was grateful for. But yes,
that's called verisimilitude, Jeff.
Yeah, sorry you don't value authenticity in your movies, Jeff. Jesus. Yeah. The other thing is that like many of the deaths are shown in extremely graphic fashion.
Yeah.
Not all of them, but many of them you see.
There's one right before the title card that's just like, wait, this, yeah, hold on. This is the movie you're in.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And,
graphic gore.
And I appreciate it. I appreciate it because I think that I'll just say in general, we are able to see and experience things in movies that we can't in real life in general, probably not in the last week, but in general, we can see and experience things in movies that we can't in real life. And confronting us with this brutality is worthwhile because there is something about, I think, the American experiment that doesn't care if people die. And that's valuable to be confronted with, in my opinion. So anyway, some thoughts on The Long Walk.
I want to point out maybe it feels like Judy Greer was cast here almost as a joke because it's very much the thing we make fun of. Anytime Judy Greer is cast, she's always like forlorn mother. Like she's always like bereft mother about something going wrong, who's not in the movie very long, but she leaves an impact. So again, Judy Greer did it. Did the job.
She's good. She's good. All right, folks, let's do a few spoilers for The Long Walk starting right now.
I thought up an ending for my book.
It makes no damn sense.
Compels me, though.
I didn't come here to tell you how this is going to end.
When I buy a new book, I always read the last page first. That way, in case I die before I finish, I know how it ends.
You can't handle the truth!
Inconceivable!
I came here to tell you how it's going to begin.
All right, let's talk about spoilers. You know, I gotta say that the Mark Hamill performance didn't really work for me, and this is weird, but it didn't work for me because of the outfit. I'm just because the outfit just felt very silly to me. It felt like yeah. ill-fitting.
I think that's part of the point, like in terms of fascist iconography. It's just he's a small man, but he looks tough because he's wearing a big general's outfit.
Yes, but it just ended up. I think you're right, Devendra, that there's something to that. That idea of it, maybe it's supposed to look silly, but as a result, I couldn't take him very seriously. And I think you're supposed to. Also, I guess he's the guy that goes around executing people for thought crimes. You know, they don't have a lower level people do that work. It's got to be the major. But I think the biggest thing that was pretty ridiculous was at the end, they're like, this guy is the major's son. That was That was one twist too many.
And obvious, fucking obvious from the word go. The moment he goes, good luck, son, I'm like, well, there's
It has no bearing on the movie.
Right.
That's right.
It's just like, it's a thing that happens.
So that's how this whole fucking dumbass movie is.
Okay. But
I,
it's
I
like.
I really hated it.
Did you like this movie?
Tell us about like why. This isn't just like you did not enjoy it, Jeff. This is you actually hated like it.
It was an insult. Like it believes it is being so profound. Mm-hmm. And it felt to me, and I, you know, all due respect to you guys who got something out of it, and I'm glad you did. It felt to me like it had absolutely nothing to say. Mm-hmm. At no point did I believe any second of this movie. And I think the only retort is, well, it's a metaphor, so it doesn't have to actually make sense because it's a metaphor. It's like, well, it's the most obvious fucking metaphor I could possibly imagine. It doesn't reveal anything to me because it is so pat and so... It's there's no nuance, there's no insight. It is just making the metaphor literal, and it's
what is metaphor in your opinion, by the way, just so we're clear.
Oh, we have to keep going until we die, and you know, there's this promise of something at the end, but like there's no universe where everybody would sign up for this. Oh, because it's a metaphor that we all do actually sign up for it. Yeah, but there,
well, in the it's clear that they are forced to involintarily.
They're basically
sign up for
being forced to do it, Jeff.
No, that's not what they said. They said we all sign up for this. We all want to do it. We all sign up for the lottery.
They don't know anybody who has not signed up.
Yeah,
for
they
it.
Don't know anybody who has not signed up for it. That's a
thinking
key point in
about
the
fact that wait, why does everybody sign up for this? So that's weird.
I think it is clear in the film that they are compelled to do it. Yes. So, but you know, okay, put aside that fact, right?
Well, but doesn't he constantly have the option to not do it? His mom is like, you just don't have to do it. Why are you doing it?
Well, they think so. But it turns out, as we see at the end, the rules mean fuck all to the people in charge. You think there are rules. You think like there are things like
Mean fuck all? He literally follows the rule of giving him the gun at the end, which is the dumbest fucking thing I've ever seen in my life.
I mean, they kill the Cooper Hoffman kid for no reason. He didn't hit all his. They killed him because he was pissed off that he started that whole chant, essentially.
The way you do this movie, in my opinion, again, I'm not trying to be the party pooper here, but the way you do this movie, and honestly, Hunger Games got this right. I'm not a fan of Hunger Games, but they got this right, is if you are going into a thing where you know up front that the rules are everyone dies but the winner. You don't start off by going, I just want to make some friends along the way. No, you go in going, I have to be look out for number one. You think,
sure.
You know how cutthroat people are on Survivor? Can you imagine mm-hmm. how they would be if everyone else died but the winner? This movie is so stupid in that they're like, hey, let's just all be friends and let's help each other up when we fall down. Like, no, what would happen is what I think a more competent narrative would convey. And again, they do this in Hunger Games, is we all think we're looking out for number one because that's the only way to do this. But along the way, we realize, oh my God, there's some inherent humanity that we need to find and capture, and there's camaraderie that is discovered, instead of literally the first moment of the thing is, hey, does everybody want to be friends? Do we all want to be the Three Musketeers? In what universe do you want to help somebody make your life harder along this walk? And I guess the answer is, well, it's a metaphor, which is, it just makes me think less of this movie.
I mean, I just disagree with the premise of what you're saying. Like, yeah. I think that in that scenario, the human beings long for camaraderie, no matter what the activity is. I've been in massive poker tournaments. The idea of a poker tournament is you start out with 10,000 players, and at the end, one lives, right? Mm-hmm. One makes it to the end. People are still befriending each other. Sometimes they're befriending each other for their own purposes. Sometimes they're like doing so in order to be manipulative later. But like,
people, the point being,
people, none of that exists in the movie.
My point is, people long for connection, and mm-hmm. it's not out of the realm of possibility for me that people at this age who aren't as hardened by the world as you, Jeff, and cunning in this environment might be like, hey, we're all like, most of us are going to die. We might as well like enjoy it along the way. That feels very plausible to me.
The difference with Hunger Games is the Hunger Games, that game forces the kids to kill each other. That's what you were signing up for, you know? And in this one, it's state violence.
Right. Yeah,
We're all trying to get there. Yes, but we're not like, not too many people are actively like trying to shove the others off the road or anything. Like, it is all or nothing, really. But it also seems like we're all just trying to survive and get there.
It might not be how I handled it, Jeff. I agree with you, but like, it's the way it's shown in the movie is not at all implausible to me. So my defense of this is not it's a metaphor. My defense is no, it's actually plausible as depicted in the film. Like, that is how I feel about it. I don't think it's a metaphor.
I think the idea that everybody that signed up for this wouldn't be constantly thinking only one of us gets to live and would be acting accordingly feels implausible to me.
And there are some literally characters who
watch just 1 mile. Like, what happens in real life, and this is not life and death, is these guys all show up and they're like, hey man, good luck, but also I'm going to win and I'm going to beat you by beating you down. Because
those are hardened athletes who are, Jeff, you're rolling your eyes, but these are very different. Yeah,
these are
just kids thrown into this thing.
Everyone is forced to participate. Like,
they all know
that
what it takes. They all want to do this. They've all decided to do it.
A lot of them don't want to do it.
And they all want to win. What is conveyed in the movie is that they have ambition to win. And the other thing that is whatever.
I actually think there's a fundamental misunderstanding, Jeff, all the kids are required to participate. It is the illusion of voluntary participation, right? Everyone is quote unquote
required to participate. But they're not unaware of what the requirements are to do
That's
it.
True. That's
you don't wake up one day and you're not pulled out of your house and thrust into the long walk. There is a structure.
They understand what the rules of the game are.
They understand what the rules are and what they have to do. They all are steeped in history of how this has worked.
Yes.
They all understand. The one guy's like, here's a good strategy, here's a bad strategy. None of them are, you know, these spring, summer children who are like, what is this magical fun time?
It is plausible, Jeff, that they don't fully know the level of the violence going on there. Like, at one point, one of them imagined, like, oh, I thought I had imagined maybe the major would pull out a gun and it would just be like, it would just say bang. But this stuff is getting televised.
There's no evidence of that at any point in the movie.
Well, that is what they're saying. I think what is true, though, is that
we don't
know if the deaths are televised, right? Like,
yes, we don't know how the violence is televised.
Right.
But there's no evidence of that. There's somebody offhandedly mentions that it's for an audience, but there's no
cameras, Jeff.
But the fact that Devendra, like, Devendra's point was like, one of the guys thought, oh, the gun would just say bang. Is like,
yes,
maybe in his mind, the government doesn't actually kill these people. Like, maybe they just, one person, they say they kill, but it's like a metaphor and they're not actually killing. So, but in my
understanding, that's a great detail for one character, but the idea that all 50 of these dudes would have the same and that is not borne out in how they all behave with each other.
They do, like, specifically, Jeff, they do say, smile for the camera. It's creepy that they're watching us. They are all aware, and it's said several times, that this is a televised event, that the entire country,
I understand that they say it, but the movie does not convey. There's no logistical understanding of the rules of that, how that works. Like, they are in the middle of goddamn nowhere. I think the movie fails on a fundamental level of conveying the structure of that, other than them being like, yeah, they film us. There's no movie, there's no camera.
There are cameras.
We do see cameras.
They point to the cameras.
You know, Jeff, I understand why you think it's a weakness. I will say, from my own perspective, I thought that was actually a really great way of putting you in the subjective view of these participants, which is they wouldn't necessarily know, like, they capture all this footage and then they don't know exactly how it's used, how it's edited. Like, that's what they would experience. And the movie puts you into that perspective. And that is one of the things I appreciated about the movie. In my opinion, that is a feature, not a bug of the movie, that no one lays out for you. Here is the broadcast schedule of The Long Walk. We show it in 8 episodes. Like, no one tells you that because it doesn't matter. Well, it's not important to the film. Right?
That is a reductive view of what I would expect. That's not, I would not say, oh, we need to see the broadcast schedule. I would not, having some understanding of literally the mechanics of what is filmed and what is not filmed, I think would be additive, not subtractive. But that's a difference of opinion that
I mean, it would be a different thing.
Sorry for exaggerating, Jeff, but like, I was just saying that the thing that you think is bad, I think is good. That's the thing I was trying to say.
But in doing so, you tried to convey what I think is bad as not accurate to what I actually think.
That's fair. Yeah. You just wanted some additional details, and I'm saying I think the amount of details we got was actually really effective. So that's our
challenge. Let's talk about the ending, because the ending is a catastrophe.
I would agree that the ending is bad for this thing. Yeah. So at the end of the movie, what happens? It ends up being Ray and McReese, right? Those are the two guys left at the end, and the whole film, Ray has been saying, well, the reason I want to get to the end is I want to kill the major, because maybe that will end the Hunger Games. And also, he killed my dad. He was the guy who personally shot my dad for some reason. And then McReese says, hey, don't, dude, like, choose love. And so then Ray gets to the end. And, I actually thought that the movie was going to do the quote unquote obvious thing, which is have McReese die, and then Ray is the one at the end. But no, all of a sudden, Ray sacrifices himself. And by the way, Devendra, I didn't understand your remark earlier about, like, that didn't make sense.
He stops.
He stops.
And then McReese did not have a chance to really say much, because I don't think he met all the warning requirements.
I see.
It felt like they killed him before the warning.
Right, sure. Like, in reality,
he did not have three.
Maybe he was already on violation 3. Who knows?
I don't think that was the case.
The case is, like, he stops, and he was going to eventually accumulate the violations to be killed.
But they kill him before that happens. Like, the one thing these guys existed is kind of the rule set of this. And I think McReeves is sort of responding to that. It's like, wait a minute. I wanted to do this.
Okay, well, that was not my I didn't really have that perception, but fair enough.
I don't know. I have to go.
I'm open to that. To me, it felt like whatever in some way, Garrity is going to accumulate enough violations to be shot. So then he does.
His violation was personally affronting the major, apparently.
I don't know. And there were some other rules about that weren't entirely clear. Like, if you go after the lights, they'll shoot you.
Doesn't matter.
Die slowly.
Like, they can do whatever they want.
The state can
do whatever they want.
I agree. Okay. So then McReese gets to the end of the game and he says, I want a carbine. And he takes the weapon and shoots the major and then walks off into the night.
Do we know if any of that actually happened? Because the point where he grabs the gun, and his whole walk off, there's a cheering audience. There's people around. They all disappear. They all fade away.
It is weird. It is very dreamlike in the final shots, right?
So I think the actual final shot of him walking away, like, that doesn't seem like that actually happened. Now, the question is, we don't actually know if he got to shoot the major or did they just off him? Because, like, yeah, obviously I know what the fuck you're thinking. I just killed your friend. I'm not an idiot. I think a lot of that ending thing is just kind of a dreamscape that we cannot fully determine the reality of.
Interesting. Yeah. Well, I was disappointed. By
I would not
the
take it literally.
I was disappointed by the ending just because it's so... it, you know, it's not inappropriate for the film, but it's sad that McVries was a character who seemed to have principles for the whole film,
sure,
only to abandon them in the final moments. And I understand that therefore the movie's trying to say something about the corrupting influence of whatever, you know, of
your friend,
hate your friend, like of anger and revenge and vengeance, right? Like, and how corrupting that can be. Jeff, none of this is resonating with you. That's fine.
Could not have hated him more, obviously.
Yeah, but tell me, like, what your reaction was to that ending.
I mean, I think you summed up an aspect of it, which is like, you know, first of all, so logistically, there's a crowd at the there's an end, and there's a crowd. What if there's still five people walking at that point?
Yeah,
they were on the end.
I agree that it's, first of all, it's very clever that the movie puts in, oh, hey, there's no crowds for the long walk, and then they don't need any extras for the, like, logistically. That's very smart, in my opinion. But very smart. You're right. How would they predict that this is the end? Who knows? Maybe, Jeff, they have an average, and they're like,
sure, they have an average, but there was two guys at the end.
Right.
If they didn't sacrifice themselves, they just walk into the crowd, and now what? We keep walking?
Right,
the crowd. Oh, walking, sorry, guys. This wasn't the actual.
People
none of it
show
makes
up for
any
parades.
Sense.
People show up for parades. They only watch a small port. You know, they show up at a parade and they watch it go by, and then it's over.
That's not what was conveyed in this movie. What was conveyed is this is the end fair. Celebration.
Yeah, fair.
Like, we've run a marathon.
I agree that logistically there's some weirdness about how the crowd could be there the whole time. Okay, putting that aside, what do you think about the message?
To me, it's consistent with the entire movie's sloppiness in regard to its own fiction. Okay, take that away. I hated the fact that, like, I'm going to give myself up for you. No. I'm going to give up myself for you. It's again, a sloppy, lazy, and I think redundant kind of way to pull that off. Then exactly what you said, which is this person who has for the entire movie lived with one ethos that I think is admirable, is one character who's like trying to turn the tide. You know, his whole thing was, my wish is going to be two people can win.
Yeah. Which is very, very beautiful and lovely. I thought, you know, that's a lovely thought. That's a lovely idea.
And I mean, the entire notion that we give you all the money and a wish is what the fuck? And the one guy asked for an elephant to ride off on, and they had one. Like, and I'm going to ask for a car. I mean, maybe Devendra's right, and maybe this is all a dream sequence, and which I would even hate more, but whatever. But the idea that he would be like, sure, give him the carbine. You're not going to shoot me, right, son? Why would he ask for the carbine? Otherwise, I want to pass it down. Take the bullets
plausible.
Out before you give it to him.
Yeah,
maybe.
That's
how
true.
About that?
Should have done that. That's
like
true.
Literally do anything that's not the stupidest version of every moment in this movie. And so, yeah, by that point, and then what, you know, there's literally no resolution. It's just, he does the thing that the other guy wanted to do. And then he walks off, and maybe that's real. Maybe it's not, but who gives a fuck? I don't know. You know,
Jeff, like, are you ambivalent about this movie? I can't tell. It's but to engage with the movie on its own terms, not wanting it to be something else or try to fix it. I think like the whole thing.
Just to
the
be clear, I think Jeff is engaging with it on its own terms. He just doesn't like it, so that's fine. But go ahead.
I'm trying by explaining how it could be better. I'm showing what I didn't like.
I don't feel like Jeff is not engaging with the movie on its own terms right at this moment.
It's anyway, the whole thing, like what McVries does is surprising and shocking, but it seems in response to him being shocked by the death of his friend, but also. He had his own like flowery interpretation of like love and everything. And I think that was before he kind of saw the full extent of like how much the state will go against. Like, it doesn't care about the rules. It doesn't matter. It doesn't really matter. They will kill who they want. They will do whatever they want. And to me, it seemed like a very natural response. The reality of what actually happens, we don't know. We don't know. As I recall having, I read some articles about like how this movie differed with the book. The book is even like a little...
Let's talk about that a little bit. So I'm reading here from Polygon.com, which is writing about the ending of the book. And so at the end of the book, there's just Stebbins and Garrity, who keep going in silence for a long, unclear period of time until Garrity catches up with Stebbins to admit defeat, and Stebbins promptly drops dead. By that time, Garrity is so physically and mentally broken by the ordeal that he can't even register that he's won the competition. Hallucinating shadows in the distance and thinking they are contestants he still has to beat, he shrugs off the people trying to congratulate him and just keeps going, end quote. So that is the ending of the book. It is, in my opinion, way even darker than what we got in the movie.
Yeah.
And Jeff, do you think you would have liked that ending more? Just out of curiosity.
I do, actually.
Yeah, I think
that's a little bit better.
It is a little bit more Hollywood, this ending, right? It's a little bit more, the guy gets the revenge, haha. And you know, Devendra, I know you think like we shouldn't necessarily interpret it as literal, but let's interpret it as literal.
By the time he's holding the gun, there's no crowd. The whole situation.
It is strange, and then the very final shot is similar to that scene I just read in the book, right? From the Polygon.com.
And there's no crowd. There's no other soldiers. It's just kind of a dreamy roadscape that he's like walking into.
Yeah. But I think Jeff, you would have at least admired the courage of its convictions in that situation, probably, right?
Right.
Whereas this is kind of like, I mean, in some ways, this ending is also really dark, right? Is that this pure soul who just wants the best for his friend and doesn't care about the rules of the game and wants to change the rules of the game to better for more people can be corrupted by this process, right? That is kind of what this movie is saying. And in some ways, that is also extremely dark. But so they're both dark endings.
I'm sorry, Jeff.
You know, like I sense what you find issue. You take issue with it in this movie is probably what I would describe as narrative shoddiness. To me, there are a handful of things that are weird or strange, like holes that the movie could plug. But overall, I found the shoddiness to be, or what you describe as shoddiness to be, just incomplete information that the characters are given and to be like a completely plausible way of how those characters would exist in that environment. But not all movies I wish I had seen the movie you guys saw.
Yeah. I really, I'm always rooting for movies to work, and I'm glad you guys liked this one. And it seems like a lot of people share that sentiment. I am, you know, baffled by it, but you know, I'm always rooting for movies to be good. I just, in this one,
I think there is a part of me that appreciates a movie like this that shows how brutal America can be, and it shows it in unflinching fashion. And so that's just the part that speaks to me, you know. And I can't speak for anyone else, but that for me, that's what really worked about this movie. So, anyway, at the end of the day, despite everything we've just said, it is really impressive that Francis Lawrence made a movie. And that's going to bring us into this week's episode of the podcast. You can find more episodes of this show at thefilmcast.com. Email us at /filmcast@gmail.com. Guys, I just realized I never finished saying what the joke was that I put in the weekly plugs.
We were all waiting so patiently.
But here it is.
You must be joking.
Yes. I'm not joking, but he is.
Yep.
There it is. That's the reward for listening to the weekly plug segment this week, guys. Thank you so much for that. All right. Anyway, that's going to bring us to the end of this week's episode of the podcast. Our music comes from Tim McEwen from The Midnight. He wrote our theme song. Our weekly plugs bumper and spoiler bumper comes from Noah Ross, who also edited this episode. And video assistance provided by Kurt Mega and John Barry. Next week on the podcast, I believe it's going to be him, right? Is the movie. There is no
him?
Screenings for this. I have not received a screening invite for this.
Oh, I got a screening. I can't go to it, but I got one.
Oh, nice. Maybe I have a screening as well. In fact, you're probably right about that. But anyway.
It's tomorrow night.
Yeah. Okay. I got to double check on that. Anyway, him is the movie next week. Should be an interesting one. But until then, thank you so much for listening to the Filmcast. And we'll see you later. Goodbye.